Ella closed her prayer with something, at least a motif or a thought that I have on a regular basis, the idea that what we do here needs to go home with you. If it don't, I'm not sure what the purpose is. So I'll give you a little bit of my journey this morning in a host of ways, but I'm only doing that to illustrate that I want you to be searching while we speak and look to the text about your own journey, those things that trigger memories in your own life. If you were to come to our house today, you would find out it's probably well lived in and dirty. It's been a rambunctious kind of week. Haven't been a lot of time to clean where we sleep at night because we've been other places and doing things. If you come in the front door, you go up 5 steps, and immediately inside the front door, you should see on your right-hand side a picture about this big that we've talked about some before. It's the road to Emmaus. A little different context this morning. In my growing up on the farm, in a drafty farmhouse, any of you remember paint by numbers? Okay. My mom got into that at one point. One of the first things she attempted was the road to Emmaus. So when I see that picture inside our house was an intentional purchase when we built a new house in Findlay. We wanted people coming in the front door to know that we believed in fellowship and that we believed in the hope of that road. And it's really kind of interesting. It was done by a Greek artist named Chrysophana Vazatzi. And it's called Finding Hope and Healing on the Road to Emmaus. Every time I see that picture, or the one that hung in the new house that they built in the 60s for 35 years, or that laid in the house that we just sold in the dining room for 16 years, every time I see that picture, I smell the paint of the paint by numbers in the farmhouse now over 60 years ago. Our memories have an interesting ability to transport us in time and circumstance, to feel a lot of the same emotions that we felt. A lot of times in marriage counseling, counselors will send couples back to the old haunts, the pizza shop, or in our case, walking on the airport runway, because going back to the familiar triggers a lot of the emotions and the feelings that you had at that particular time. Just underneath the picture hanging on the wall is one of those old, I don't know probably the right name, I don't know if it's a trundle, a sewing machine that had the rocker foot pedals on the bottom kind of thing. That and the wedding clock on the top of it belonged to Debbie's grandmother. Lydia was her name. It has a kind of, it looks like brass, but it's not. It's cheaper than that. A guy on a horse on the top of it. And all of that piece, every time the clock clicks, I think of Lydia. Every time it chimes, I remember who they called Little Biddy. I don't know if she ever made it to 5 foot. When I got to know her, she was bent over enough that not, but she had a sparkle in her eye that the only other place I've ever seen it, I married, okay? Every time the clock clicks, I think of Lydia. Every time I look at the picture, I smell the paint of Mom trying to stay in the lines on a paint by number. What are the memories that you're carrying with you this morning? And what power do they have? What power should they have? Just take a couple more steps, and there's a picture of a rural church, kind of a Vermont picture postcard. It's a frame piece that was given to me of the second church that I pastored. Just above that, with a kind of a light that shines down on it, I may have talked about this before because I think a part of it's funny, there's a bust of Jesus that's serially numbered. Like there was a lot more than the one that we worship. I just found it. I made some comment about it in my second church, and it now sits on a handmade walnut-crafted curio shelf made by people in the second church, because they talked about Jesus didn't have a place to rest his head, sort of thing. When I look up at Jesus, I don't see the serial number. I see the faces of the people that gave it to me. I know what pew they sat in. I remember the comments that they made as they exited after good and bad sermons. If you take a hard right, you'll find a guest bathroom and a guest bedroom at the end of like a 6-foot hall with a three-way light switch, Jerry, on each end, which I don't, you know, if you can't reach one, I can get them both with the same hand. Not the contractor, just kind of dumb. We call it the Haiti room. When we bought the house, it was a bland kind of neutral shade, which they do with most model homes, because then you can see your own colors and what you would want to do to it. We call it the milk carton room because it, you know, if you remember milk cartons, it just had a strange kind of cathedral ceiling in a small room. We painted it kind of a sage green, toned it down a little bit, and virtually everything in there beyond our own initial bedroom set is from Haiti. So we call it the Haiti room. There's a hand-carved Haitian about this tall. And I remember going up in the mountains and getting it. And the salesman did a really good job of holding it and tapping it and stuff. And I found out part of the reason that he held it like that when he was trying to present it to us is it won't stand on its own without falling over. I had to borrow a suitcase from the missionary to get it on the airplane because of its size. It's just an ongoing story. If you go to the back of the room, there's a hand-carved walking stick that has a snake wrapped around it with a Haitian head on the top of it. I remember pulling it out of the above luggage box on the airplane and Haitians behind me screaming. They don't like snakes. About the only thing in that room that's not from Haiti is a spray of flowers that the national office provided at my father's funeral. Virtually everything in our home has a backstory. If you go farther into the living room, there's a triple matted glass framed watercolored serial numbered titled Alyssa. It's the name of our oldest granddaughter, and it's actually spelled the way that's important, because right now we're praying for that prodigal to come home. If you go to the other side of the television and sit on the couch, there's another triple matted framed one-day first cover like I passed around a while back. It's got to do with the War of 1812. That's our house address. And there have been a few wars in our house, okay? If you go out in the garage, there are some animal heads that belong to my grandfather, who was a pretty good shot. In the basement, there are some trophies on how many shots he was able to make without missing at all. Pride that I had as a kid in grade school is I took in a black and white glossy of my grandfather shooting against Roy Rogers. Grandpa beat him. Mostly boxed now, because there's a section of the basement ceiling that needs repaired after taking the office lights down and repainted. The other half's done, so only part of them are displayed. But there's probably somewhere close to 300 coffee cups. None of them match. Most of them have either receipts inside or tickets or something that commemorates why we got them. One of the really dumb ones is a rubberized thing, a Wile E. Coyote with a really long nose. Is that significant, Bob? We bought it at a meal after a baptism we did from a morning Bible study I was doing. There's a story behind all 300 cups. What's your story? If I rambled enough for you to tap into some of that, what are those things that immediately trigger emotions? There was one other thing in the Haiti bedroom that wasn't from Haiti. It's kind of a melted wedding candle. It's kind of discolored, and it sort of just melted down into the little, I don't know what they used to call it. It was like little plates for bones and stuff. It's sitting on that, but it's wrapped. It's over 49 years old. It deserves to be a little woolly. It's our wedding invitation. Every time I look at the candle, I remember an unusual November 70-degree day. The sun is bright and shining just before a storm that shut everything down with the blizzard. Cindy and I were talking earlier about our lives are a collection of the decisions that we've made. Aren't they also a collection of the memories of those decisions? This sounds really simplistic, but if you don't like your life, you need to make some different decisions. If you don't think God's been good to you, you need to remember His faithfulness. Sometimes the day is so cloudy and so gloomy, you think, God, where in the world are you in all of this? That's when we need to hear Jesus again say, remember. That's when you need to hear a guy on sabbatical find out that part of the assignment was remembering God's faithfulness. Let's go to the text. I could talk about Grandpa's fishing rod and the plaid hat and all kind. I could go on and on. That's not the point. The point is, what are the memories that trigger Thanksgiving in your heart and life? The text this morning, and Jeff may give you more than what I'm going to, chapter 4 in the book of Joshua, said, when the whole nation had finished crossing the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, choose 12 men from among the people from each tribe and tell them to take up 12 stones in the middle of the Jordan, right where the priests had stood, and carrying them over with you, put them down at the place where you might stay tonight. Remember that a little bit later. So Joshua called together 12 men, appointed the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, go over to the Ark of the Covenant of your Lord into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of tribes the Israelites to serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean? Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord when it crossed to the Jordan. The waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever. First part of verse 8 is really important, and we're going to jump. So the Israelites did as Joshua commanded them. Verse 19. On the 10th day of the first month of the people up from the Jordan camped on the Gilgal on the eastern border of Jericho. And Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan. He said to the Israelites, in the future when your descendants ask their fathers, what do these stones mean? Tell them, Israel crossed. You understand the importance of repetition? I think we did a message about repetition at one point. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan just what he had done to the Red Sea. So in this contemporary miraculous event, he's reminding them of miracles he had done for his people before. And in essence saying, watch, I'm doing it again. The Lord your God did to the Jordan just what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us, ownership, until he had crossed over. He did this so that the peoples of the earth, this wasn't just a selfish thing for a handful of people, he did it so the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful and so that you might always fear the Lord your God. We've danced in and out of the book of Joshua several times since I've been here. We'll probably do more of that when I'm around. It's a favorite of mine. I don't know, maybe I ask this as a question. Where is the well that you go to biblically? Where's the place that you repeatedly find something that speaks to you? What do you tap into when the week hasn't gone so well? Or maybe when the week has gone really well? Where's that place that you go in God's Word that you almost always find something? For me, Joshua is one of those places in the Old Testament. There's always a leadership issue there. There's always a story there. There's always a model there to look at. It's just always a good one for me. As I navigate my own journey through life, would this land be theirs just because God promised it to the forefathers? Would they live in houses they've not built, eat grapes that they've not planted? Would there be battles to fight? Should they roll up their sleeves, polish their army, plan an attack? Type this sometime back. My parents built a house in Ohio, stick built, took a year to build it. They left that house coming to Indiana. Neither of them had ever lived out of the state before. There was some journey there about not knowing where they were going to. They moved into a nice house that we just sold. We felt compelled to sell it. It wasn't our game plan. It was just like God in your face kind of thing. You need to do this and do it now. But where are you taking us? What are you doing with this, God? We think we know some answers to some of that. But again, what I'm trying to help you to do repeatedly is find yourself in the story. This fit the last couple of weeks of our life as well as the first almost 50. It's not about me. It's what is God doing in your journey? Sometimes it's really hard. You know, we read the stories and think, God tell them, I'll give it to you. I'll explain this to you when we get foot. Maybe I'll never explain it to you as part of the risk. The heroes of the faith are the people that were obedient, even when it made no sense. So that's a nice story. The issue is, what in your life seems to make absolutely no sense at all? And God very gently is saying, I got this. It's going to make some sense down the road. Hopefully for me in this life. I told you I'm not patient. But most of the people in Hebrews, they believed and they never saw it completed. That's where the rubber meets the road this morning for you. What's going on in your life right now that seems to make absolutely no sense? If you don't hear anything else this morning, hear God's got it. He's bigger than this. He can handle it. There's nothing that he can't do except maybe get your cooperation. Quickly as I can, I'm going to give you three things. The objects of memories. First is memories reproduce really strong emotions. Perfumes, colognes. I saw on Facebook a couple of weeks ago, a guy was listening to his wife, and she was saying, had some really good memories in a 57 Chevy. It got my attention because I had one. To which the guy said, I never had a 57 Chevy. But she had some really good memories in a 57 Chevy. Memories produce some really strong emotions sometimes, good or bad. They cause us to reflect. That's the point of the passage. and I don't know if we'll get there or not, but you need to understand there were a couple of Gilgals. They got across the river. They set up the zone. Like there's another one 6 miles in that saved, you know, the floodplain and that kind of stuff. That one historically, I believe, is still there. They produce strong emotions, cause us to reflect, and they can and should stimulate divine praise and thanksgiving. Because of the nature of our few weeks, we've had a lot of time to reflect. Biggest part of our reflection right now is we can't believe we've been married almost 50 years. That's just beyond our comprehension. But we could, with a little bit of a slowdown, see God's hand all along the journey. That's why we need to stop and remember. And we need to thank God for his faithfulness every step of the way. I've been to an Arlington National Cemetery at least 3 times, all at different stages of my life for different reasons. And I don't want to get into that necessarily, other than I identify really strongly with some of the images in that video clip, just seeing the row of crosses or memorial stones. You know, hard for you to imagine that know me very well. I was speechless. I didn't want to talk. I didn't feel like talking. There was just something about the reverence of being in that place that held the bodies of so many people that bled literally for the country that I complain a lot. I was in quality control for about a decade. I'm a professional nitpicker. I can find something wrong with just about everything. But when you look at a sea of memorial stones that where people paid the ultimate sacrifice so I could stand there, it's just incredibly humbling to me. I don't know what the trigger points are in that place for you. The Curtis Lee Mansion, at one point was a home of Robert E. Lee that stands up on the hill, kind of yellow building as I remember. In my lifetime, the graves of Jack Kennedy, John Kennedy, and Bobby, his son, is there. His brother is there as well, his son, the Eternal Flame, that went out a couple of times. Nothing is eternal but the one that we serve. One of the more recent times I was there, partly because it was a part of my lifetime in high school, is the really long black memorial wall, 200 and some feet, 58,000 names. And I've always been pretty interested in photography. Maybe the art background, and I took a lot of pictures. I don't do it too much anymore. Everybody takes pictures. Not everybody has a photographer's eye, but everybody takes pictures and posts them on Facebook. But one that's etched in my mind, two back-to-back I'll share with you. It was a gloomy fall day, drizzling kind of. It's just an ugly day, and somehow it seemed fitting to look at the Vietnam War Memorial. She's a Bond girl. I would say she was about 5'3", very petite, very well-dressed, brown leather jacket, really tight blue jeans, kind of slightly heeled shoes, a spray of flowers in one hand, and barely able to reach out and touch a name on the wall. Emotionally covered a little bit from that visual image, and I turned around, and it wasn't a video clip because a lot of people weren't satisfied with just a black wedge V-shape. They came back and they did a bronze memorial with 3 soldiers at a different location that you saw on the screen. Close to those 3 soldiers, the brass is a platform with a book on it, and in the book are names. And in that same dreary, rainy day, I saw a couple about my age now, this was some years ago, leafing through the book, finding a name, pointing to the name, and then a full body embrace as they wept. I am still emotional about those two visual images. It's been years. But it's because they put a face on the name, and the face on the name was in their bloodline. And all of a sudden, the war that they didn't even call a war, a conflict most of the time, became real because somebody bled and died. Power in memories. Memories reproduce strong emotions. They also cause us to reflect. My first church, you may have driven by it. If you're going between Fort Wayne and Columbus on Route 33, Neptune's a small town. I was told 174 on a heavy weekend if you count the pets. It was a church, the original church caught fire and burned when Dick Wilkin was there. They rebuilt mid-50s. It was kind of a sandy, not quite a red brick A-frame, typical for the time. Gorgeous wood decking ceilings, wood arches to match. Just a really cute little building that's now been closed. As a part of the witness, they put a floodlight on the front of that church. So in this A-frame structure, kind of, they had windows at the front of the church that they found out, I'm told, before I got there, that the architect had miscalculated, and they were originally glass, but because the front of it faced the south and the swelling and shrinking, the glass broke. So they replaced it with kind of a aluminum U-channel on both sides and kind of like a plexiglass. And they even drew some lines on it so it looked like stained glass windows. But, the fiberglass plexiglass could expand and shrink, and it worked pretty well. There were two main support beams. One went vertical, the other one horizontal. At one point when they were sprucing up the church, they painted those beams in kind of a sandy dust reddish brown tone, highlighted it with like an ivory kind of color. And if you stood back and looked at it, it looked like a cross was on the front of the building. That was a witness to the community. Remember the floodlight, expensive bulbs at that time, still are. They also had one on the sign. But the big thing was they did a floodlight on the church. On one particular time in my ministry there, on one of the times, I was really discouraged. Part of my habit became on every Saturday night, I would drive the 7 miles from where we were living at the time, go to the church, and I would sit in front of the altar of the church. I went over to check to see if my memory was correct this morning to the sanctuary that you guys have. The altar is raised on a platform, which would allow you to sit on the step and pray. I did that. At Neptune, there was a fence around the table. It's actually 2x2s, so it was more of a visual kind of thing. The historicity of a fence around the table comes out of Europe, where a lot of the chapels didn't have doors, and the animals would wander into the church or the chapel. And because they didn't want the animals on the altar, they put a fence around it. Reason that's relevant today that we share communion is typically in churches when you share communion, you parameterize it by who should participate and who shouldn't. You know what that's called? Fencing the table. So when we tell people if you're not a believer, you shouldn't participate in communion, we're putting a fence around the table. Now, I could get into architecture, the split chancel with the altar at the back. We're basically saying you have to go through the priest to get to God. So put all of that in your mind. Now back to the 7-mile drive on a discouraged Saturday night. And I was sitting there praying, and to me it seemed like God was absent. I don't remember the circumstance. I don't know what was going on. Maybe I was praying to God, if you don't turn this sermon into something, I'm dead meat. I don't know if it was a relationship issue with Debbie or the kids. You know, I have no memory of that. But what haunts me in a positive way since that time is at one point I'm pouring out my heart before God at the altar, saying, I need to hear you, I need to feel you, do something real in my life that I can remember, complete silence. But I opened my eyes and realized that I was sitting in the shadow of the cross. Because of the outside light shining through the plexiglass window and the structure I described, I was literally sitting in the shadow of the cross. I had the same habit at my second church. Sometimes I go to the basement to pray on my knees. Sometimes I sit pray by the bed. Sometimes I'm sitting on the couch. But the haunting memory that I hope I carry to the grave is no matter what my position, no matter what the urgent need is, no matter where I am geographically, I'm talking to the Father in the shadow of the cross. Reflection is not dwelling in the past, using the past as a motivation for the future. It should be a catapult, not an anchor. A little bit of church history. Martin Luther, most of you know that name. Before he left the Catholic Church and married a nun that was very focused on school teaching, he lived in a monastery kind of environment, pretty close to like a bunk at church camp. And by that bunk, there were a couple of prongs stuck out of the wall that had kind of a U-hook on it. That held the whip. And Luther, when those days when like a dog returns to its vomit, when his sins are things he couldn't get rid of, he'd take the whip off the wall and he would beat himself to try to get rid of his sinfulness. There was times that he didn't think he could ever be good enough for God to grace somehow his life. He would take the whip off of the wall and beat himself to try to purify, to try to do what Jesus did on the cross. Until at one point he yells out, sola futura, which became the banner cry of the Reformation. It's only by faith we are saved. We can't whip ourselves into submission. We can't beat ourselves into submission. It's only by God's blood, the blood of Jesus and God's grace, that any of us can be saved. Third response I've mentioned to you already is our memory should trigger thanksgiving to God. I had the privilege of a friend took me to Shanksville on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 and walked the grounds, listened at the Carillon Tower, and tried to understand where God was in all of this. And I'm not going to dwell here long. I just want to say, I don't want to minimize anything at all about the loss of life at that day. But if you saw the movie, read the book, Let's Roll. There was another plane headed for D.C. They don't know for sure if it was on the way to the Capitol or the White House. But some brave people on that plane took over the plane to the point that it crashed in Shanksville. So while in no way do I minimize the loss that was there, I thank God every year for the people of courage that prevented it from being worse. The firemen and the people that rushed into that are still dying from the chemical effects of their endeavor to save other people. We have so much to thank our God for. Our country has so much to praise Him for. We have a lot of problems. But part of the flood of the borders is the fact that in spite of all of our difficulties, it is the best place on the planet to live. And we need to start thanking God and championing why we are what we were instead of complaining about the deterioration of a dog returned into its vomit. Memories were so important that before God led the campaign to destroy Jericho, He said, I want you to stop on the beach and remember what we've done so far. So part of what we need to remember today as we look at another birthday for our country is God's faithfulness, and remember the price that was paid, and to honestly decide what price you're willing to pay so He might use you in the lives and hearts of others.